Matter of State of Washington versus Chetty.
Yes. May it please the court. My name is Neil Fox, and I represent Mr. Chetty. Mr. Chetty,
don't take it personally. I noticed there's nobody sitting behind watching anymore. But
No. Well, Mr. Chetty was here a second ago. I think he stepped out to the washroom.
Okay.
So I just wanted to alert you that he's probably going to come back in.
Do you want to reserve any time?
2 minutes, Your Honor. As lawyers, one of the more unpleasant tasks that we have is that when your client or we lose a case, we have an obligation to sit down with our client and talk about what the options are. Sometimes our clients are upset at the time that they lose the case. They're emotionally distraught. They're crying. If you look at the videotape in this case, which is designated as an exhibit, Mr. Chetty was clearly upset at the time of sentencing. We have an obligation to set a time, either by phone.
So that was part of the record in front of Judge Kessler?
Yes. It was Exhibit 17, which was admitted, and I believe I designated it to this court. But we have an obligation to sit down with our client and to have a discussion with him or her about where they are and where the case is going and what their options are. And that applies whether it's a civil case or a criminal case.
So, but what we have here is, this is the second time that you've been here.
Yes.
So what we have here in front of us today is the question of whether the findings of fact support Judge Kessler's conclusions of law, because we sent this back for a reference hearing on the question of ineffective assistance of counsel and waiver of the right of appeal.
Right. And here the record is clear that there is no evidence that Mr. Connick ever had a discussion with Mr. Chetty about the advantages and disadvantages of an appeal.
Well, the state makes the point that a lack of memory is no substitute for affirmative evidence on the issue of whether or not counsel's conduct was deficient or not, and points to Judge Kessler's observation regarding Mr. Connick's sort of lack of memory.
Right.
What affirmative evidence is there in the record?
Well, what we have is Mr. Connick's statement about what his usual practice is. And his usual practice is, if there are forms that are given to defendants at the time of sentencing, that he...
Well, there always are.
Right. And you say, "Are you have any questions?" That's his usual practice.
And the form you're talking about is the right to appeal.
Right. So, but he also said if there's firearms forms, all these forms, his usual practice is to answer any questions the client may have. That does not conform with the standard of effective assistance of counsel that was prevalent in 2003, 2004.
So then you're relying on Jay Stansel's testimony?
Right. Now, actually, the state's own witness, Mr. Phillips, would have gone further and would have automatically filed an appeal in any contested matter.
Well, but that's all speculative because he was out by then.
Sure, but his standard of practice is you file and then withdraw rather than not file. That's the state's witness, I would note. I don't think that under Roe, the Supreme Court case in Roe, that necessarily as a standard is probably more the cautious way of proceeding. But Mr. Stansel's testimony is that you would have a deep discussion with your client. The testimony of Mr. Phillips, actually, is that you don't have deep discussions with your client at the courthouse. You set up a separate appointment, or he said go to Starbucks. I mean, I guess there's an issue about confidentiality there. But the point is, you don't do it right in court. And here, what's interesting is that both Mr. Chetty and his sister remember the separate discussion about filing an appeal. Their testimony was that Mr. Connick kind of shrugged his shoulder and said, why appeal? You're going to be out walking the streets in 6 months. Now, we have the finding from Judge Kessler that didn't happen. So in some senses, Mr. Connick's testimony is more indicative of ineffective assistance of counsel and Mr. Chetty and his sister, because they at least remember some separate conversation. Mr. Connick's practice is not to have that separate conversation. He doesn't talk about that ever happening in due course. And I think what A&J, the Supreme Court case on effective assistance of counsel, juvenile case, or we can even talk about Judge Lasnik's opinion in that Mount Vernon case in federal court, is that you can't have brief conversations at the courthouse. What's required is a more in-depth conversation where people's tempers, their stress level, their emotions have subsided, and you talk about it. And that didn't happen here. In fact, there's no evidence that any of these three lawyers ever had an in-depth conversation about immigration with Mr. Chetty. There's no indication that took place. They all believed that Mr. Chetty was concerned about immigration issues, but no one had that conversation. They structured this whole issue or the whole whole undercover agreement to avoid deportation. That's true, but once the agreement was revoked, and once Mr. Chetty was sentenced, at that point, Mr. Connick had an affirmative obligation to talk about the consequences of the conviction and to respond to the issues that he knew that Mr. Chetty had. And Mr. Connick affirmatively testified, not that he didn't remember immigration, but he never talked about immigration. He never mentioned the subject. He just assumed that Mr. Chetty knew that there was something, an appeal that was kind of possibly out there, but he never talked to him about what would happen once he was convicted and once the conviction became final. He never said it was his usual practice to do this either. So I think the record fully supports Judge Kessler's findings. There's another issue. The last time we were here, I think Judge Dwyer asked me, what about the merits of the appeal? Whether or not Mr. Chetty would prevail on the appeal. And I think I argued with you saying, well, that's not the issue before the court. As I was thinking about prejudice. And under Roe, the issue of prejudice is not whether you would prevail on the appeal. But when I go back and look at Roe, actually, you were correct. I can say that 2.5 years later.
It's a rare occasion.
but when you look at Roe, the issue is whether the attorney who's handling the case has reason to believe whether there is a rational defendant would want to appeal, whether there was a non-frivolous issue. And the record in this case
establishes that Mr. Connick thought there were non-frivolous issues.
Right. He clearly thought that the case should be appealed. And there's no reason in this case why someone wouldn't appeal. Absolutely no reason. So here you have a potential issue that the attorney believes is non-frivolous, ought to be appealed. You have dramatic and severe consequences to Mr. Chetty if he doesn't appeal. Why wouldn't he appeal? How could this possibly be a knowing and intelligent and voluntary waiver? So we believe that the record supports the conclusion that Mr. Connick was ineffective, and the state hasn't been able to show a waiver. And so under this record, I would ask that the court grant the motion to extend the time for filing the appeal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Dennis McCurdy for the State of Washington, the respondent in this case. I think it's important to start with by remembering why we're here, and that is the defendant has to prove extraordinary circumstances exist and that there's an extension of time that's necessary to correct and prevent a gross miscarriage of justice. Now, in just a few short sentences, I want to point out where this case began and a few of the facts. Originally, defendants caught red-handed in the process of a delivery. He possesses a large amount of cocaine, over 11 grams, somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000 worth. He confesses.
You would agree ineffective assistance of counsel would be an extraordinary circumstance. So
what's that?
You would agree that ineffective assistance of counsel would be an extraordinary circumstance?
It depends on what the circumstances are.
Okay.
Because ineffective assistance of counsel could broad range, broad scope of what exists. And that gets me partly to my point, because in this point, he confessed. Pete Connick says, I knew the defendant couldn't plead guilty. He knew it because of immigration consequences. Dave Gerke testified, the state was not willing to reduce or to enter into any plea negotiations. Connick says, and this is at 5313 and 220, he was never going to plead because of possible immigration consequences. He told me that. I represented him knowing that. He obviously fails in terms of the agreement worked out with the police. We end up in front of the court. He loses a stipulated trial. Judge Kessler rules that the statements the defendant makes were not true in terms of not knowing what an appeal was, finding of fact 32, that he claims Connick told him it was a waste of time and that Connick told him nothing would happen to him. Now, what's important is this should not be spoken about in just broad terms like counsel does. The question here are the immigration consequences. The defendant knew, and the court found, that he knew there were immigration consequences of his conviction. Counsel said, all three attorneys said he knew that. Counsel said this whole thing was driven.
Your point is that there was the fact that Connick didn't sit down and talk with him about it after the conviction about whether he wanted to appeal, that it's a no moment because of
that? The important thing is, and as the case law, U.S. v. Flores Ortega, 120 Supreme Court 470, is there, to prove the prejudice prong of ineffective assistance of counsel, there must be a nexus between what the deficient performance and the defendant's decision not to appeal his conviction. Now, if the defendant knew that his conviction had immigration consequences, which he did, and I think there's no dispute about that, I believe the defendant even admits it in his brief, and he knew what an appeal was, that to challenge his conviction, then where is the nexus between Connick not saying what? You can appeal your conviction? Well, he knew he could appeal his conviction. The appeal itself has no immigration consequences, and I think that's an important point to make as well. The conviction has immigration consequences. The appeal, in terms of the immigration consequences, only does one thing. If you get your conviction reversed, you go back to square one. If you lose your appeal, your immigration consequences still exist. Well, the defendant knew that. And he knew he could challenge his conviction. Now, he chose not to. Now, defense counsel says, well, why wouldn't he? Well, there are a number of reasons why he won. One is, what happens if he loses his appeal? Or, excuse me, if he wins his appeal? He simply goes back to the position he was in before. And the state could actually potentially go to trial against greater charges. Number two, and I think Mr. Connick was correct, well, you know, the more you're involved in the criminal justice system, the more opportunity you have for INS to find out about this conviction and the fact you might get deported. There are, and three is, you know, you always have to make a decision. Are there legitimate issues or are there not legitimate decisions? So there are reasons why somebody would not appeal. It happens all the time. The important aspect is, and I think as well, if you look at what the defendant says, and this is in his affidavit. Around the time I was sentenced, I asked Mr. Connick whether I should appeal or not. He told me that an appeal would be a waste of time because I would be released from custody in 3 to 6 months and I would be out of custody before an appeal was resolved. That is the reason I did not appeal. That's his claim. Well, the trial court found out that's not accurate, that he didn't believe that. Connick never said that. So again, Judge Kessler has to make a decision based on the failure of what Connick allegedly did and the defendant's decision. He never makes that connection, and I would also indicate, based on the record, there can't be one because the defendant knew the critical things, the focus of this case, not some broad idea of just whether he talked to him about it or not, but the fact that the immigration consequences, the defendant knew it. The defendant knew he could challenge his appeal. He was given oral and written notice, and he did nothing for, 7, 8 years.
Why did you submit an additional statement of authority citing the Ramos case, which addresses the question of a plea agreement and Padilla?
Well, part of it is a couple reasons. One is it does show, I think, a little bit, again, what we're talking about in terms of what you have to know and what you don't have to know. But the other thing is, one of the things that's been problematic about all these cases is the different ways the courts are handling it. We've seen that. I honestly don't remember when this case actually first started up in front of this court, but it's been, I think, a couple years. And we've seen a plethora of decisions treating these cases differently. And it's a point that I do think is important to keep in mind. If a murder case came in front of this court, 20 years old, and let's say Tony Savage was the defense attorney, who I think is pretty much respected by the state and the defense bar, and a defendant simply did an affidavit and said, you know what, I wasn't properly advised about my appellate rights, you have to question whether, first of all, that would be sufficient to even go back for a remand hearing, and then if it was, would a trial court be making findings based simply on the absence of evidence that, in fact, the defendant was improperly advised, ineffective assistance of counsel, and his convictions, or he gets the right to appeal? And I think the answer to that question is no. And that's another aspect about this case. The rulings in this case apply to every case, the legal basis and the rulings. I understand that immigration is a hot-button issue, and I respect that, and I have certain sympathies as well. But the legal consequences of the rulings in this case apply to every case. The defendant hasn't proven counsel was ineffective simply because of a lack of memory. He hasn't proven he didn't know the consequences of failing to appeal. And in fact, the record supports the fact that he did know. He knew his conviction had consequences. His attorneys said that. And there's nothing to dispute that except his own statements, which Judge Kessler found not credible. If there's any other or not any other questions. And yes, Your Honor, there is a dispute in this case.
Well, I just want to point out that on the day that we argued the appeal from the case where nobody's suing anybody, we've got the second oral argument in the case to determine whether we can have an appeal.
Exactly.
So I think it's good that we're the closest issue.
We've gone full circle in one day. Thank you, Your Honors.
Can I take some of his extra time?
No.
3 points in rebuttal, Your Honors. First, one of the issues on the appeal will be if there is substantial compliance with the agreement. The remedy for that is to send the case back, not to put it in square one, but ultimately for dismissal of the case. So there is a benefit to this case. It's not one of the reasons to appeal is not simply to waste the court's time.
Well, what's your response to the argument that Mr. Chetty knew all of the essential elements of what he needed to know in order to make a knowing, intelligent decision?
Well, I would point the court to what Judge Kessler labeled as a conclusion of law, but I would say it's a finding of fact. And I'm looking at number two. He knew that there were immigration consequences of a conviction. Defendant was not informed that his conviction would definitely result in deportation. There's a difference between being fearful of deportation, which is the whole reason why there's prejudice here, and knowing the succinct and clear consequences of this conviction. And actually, the case that counsel cited supplementally, it was interesting, Division III said that it wasn't an aggravated felony, so there was no prejudice. But here, we know now, there's no dispute that possession with intent to distribute controlled substance is an aggravated felony that has all of these very severe consequences. The second thing is counsel said, well, an appeal does not have immigration consequences. Well, actually, the record in this case is that in 2004, the mere fact of filing an appeal did have immigration consequences.
Did Judge Kessler rely on the lack of memory?
In his conclusion of law, one of the last conclusions of law, he talks about passage of time in Mr. Connick's memory, but that's not how he made those findings of fact. And again, if you look at what Mr. Connick said his standard practices were, I don't believe that there's any record that would dispute those findings of fact.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.